Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's July 17, 2020 program. Should citizens choose their legislators or legislators choose their citizens? This is the 39th program of our 2019-20 programming year. My name is Scott Coltrane, and I'm the City Club President. Before I introduce today's program on election redistricting, I would like to thank our Diamond sponsors. Kaiser Permanente exists to provide high-quality, affordable health care services and to improve the health of their members and the communities they serve. More information at www.kp.org. Support comes from University of Oregon. Since 1876, UO has helped Oregonians question critically, think logically, reason effectively, communicate clearly, act creatively, and live ethically. More information at uoregon.edu. Peace Health is proud to serve Eugene, Lane County, and beyond. As your hometown health care provider for more than 80 years, Peace Health's mission is to keep you and your family healthy. Learn more at peacehealth.org. Lane Community College transforms lives through learning. LCC provides comprehensive, accessible, high-quality educational opportunities that promote student success. For more information, visit lanecc.edu. I would also like to thank the City of Eugene and Lane County for their generous support. On to today's program. Every 10 years, after the results of the U.S. Census have been tallied, the boundaries of congressional, state, and local districts and wards must be redrawn to try to achieve the goal of one person, one vote. This process is more complicated than first meets the eye. Does the result seem to be unbiased? Can politics be taken out of the process? Oregon state law requires many things of districts. They must be contiguous, utilize existing geographic or political boundaries, and be connected by transportation links. They should not be drawn for the purpose of favoring a political party, incumbent, or other person, nor should they divide communities of common interest. Current Oregon law leaves it up to the legislature, in the first instance, to draw these lines. A proposal by People Not Politicians, a group affiliated with the League of Women Voters, seeks to amend the Oregon Constitution. They propose to create a panel of 12 citizens, four from each of the top three political parties, to conduct the redistricting process. I would like to thank Joel Corin, former president of City Club and chair of the program committee, for coordinating today's program. Stuart Chin will begin by providing background on some of the major U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with gerrymandering and attempts to curb some of the abuses. Senator Lee Beyer, who served on the last two redistricting commissions, will describe the current Oregon practices. And Norman Terrell, the chief petitioner on the People Not Politicians ballot measure, will talk about the proposed amendment. Stuart Chin earned BA, PhD in political science, and JD degrees from Yale University. He is currently an associate professor of law and the associate dean for programs and research at the University of Oregon Law School. He writes and teaches about constitutional law, legislation, and legal and political history. His book, Recalibrating Reform, The Limits of Political Change, was published by Cambridge University Press in 2014. Chin also has published in major peer-reviewed journals and law reviews. Senator Lee Beyer served in the military and subsequently attended Lane Community College and graduated from the University of Oregon with a degree in management. Beyer's community service began in 1978 when he was appointed to the Springfield City Planning Commission. He was elected to the Springfield City Council in 1986, serving there until 1993. In 1991, he entered the Oregon legislature as a state representative. In 1998, Beyer was elected to the state Senate. Norman Terrill is the chief petitioner on the People Not Politicians proposal. His early involvement with the anti-war movement blossomed into a commitment to civic and political activism, with a particular focus on political reform. As a member of the Oregon State Board of Common Cause, Terrill worked to make government more transparent through sunshine laws and other reforms. He was one of the first men to join the League of Women Voters. Much of his work with the league on the state and national levels has involved technology. While on the national board, he oversaw the creation of the league's website and developed the League Geeks, who use social media to broaden the league's membership and expand its voter education efforts. Now, on to today's program. Stuart, we will begin with you.
Well, thank you for having me here today. With my time, I want to start by just offering a few comments about the recent federal case law on partisan gerrymandering. And in doing so, I want to draw out on some recurring critical themes about the practice of partisan gerrymandering and try to clarify what exactly is troubling about it. And I'll try to conclude with a few thoughts at the end about my own thoughts about the problems of partisan gerrymandering and how we might think about proceeding to deal with it at this particular moment in our political life. So first, just to be clear about what the term generally denotes, the conventional understanding of what partisan gerrymandering is this practice of a state legislature intentionally drawing voting district lines for state and or federal elections in such a way as to give an advantage to a particular political party. So generally, of course, if one party is in power in a state legislature, they're going to draw those lines to favor their own party. But there's also a related concern as well about a situation where there might be incumbents of both parties who might draw lines in such a way to favor incumbents of either party. So with respect to the black letter case law at the federal level, the last two major cases on partisan gerrymandering ended up sounding pretty similar themes to each other. The first case was this case called Veith versus Jubilier in 2004. And writing for a closely divided Supreme Court, Justice Scalia held that partisan gerrymandering claims were non-justiciable in the federal courts. That is to say, these types of cases presented controversies that were, according to Scalia and the majority, inappropriate for federal judicial resolution. And the reason why Scalia came to this conclusion was actually a theme that Chief Justice Roberts later echoed in our more recent case in Rucho. But basically, he argued that it was impossible for the Supreme Court or any other federal court to settle on judicially discernible and manageable standards for adjudicating these claims, right? That is to say, it was impossible for courts to draw lines and dictate or to indicate what was a troubling partisan gerrymander and what was just normal politics in drawing district lines. So as a result, Scalia and the court majority thought that the Supreme Court shouldn't get involved in these cases. And you know, for those who know their constitutional law, these arguments had a great deal of familiarity because they were ones that were echoed, or these were arguments echoed arguments that were earlier made by Felix Frankfurter in the malapportionment cases decades earlier, where he was in the losing minority of the court that argued against the Supreme Court getting involved in malapportionment, or basically where voting districts had unequal numbers of residents. So Veith was an important case. With it, the court ultimately overruled the then leading precedent of Davis versus Bandemir from 1986, where the court had concluded that partisan gerrymandering claims could be justiciable and heard by the courts. But of course, here in Veith, the court went in the opposite direction. Now, there was one uncertainty left open by Veith, and as was often the case with the Supreme Court during these years, that uncertainty rested with the vote of Justice Kennedy. Justice Kennedy, crucial swing vote in a number of the court's most important controversies during this time, and he had a very interesting swing vote in Veith. He agreed with the court majority that the court shouldn't intervene in the litigation that was presented in Veith, but he had an interesting twist to that. He also insisted that, contrary to what the rest of the majority indicated, the court should not abstain from hearing on all future partisan gerrymandering claims. He actually expressed to the contrary the hope that in the future, the court could develop a workable standard for adjudicating partisan gerrymandering claims. So if you look at Kennedy, what he says about this possibility of a future standard and combine it with the liberal bloc of Stevens, Souter, Ginsburg, and Breyer, in 2004 at least, that indicated 5 votes on the court for the possibility that the court could in the future intervene in these partisan gerrymandering cases. So even though Veith certainly went in the direction of judicial non-involvement, there was a silver lining that perhaps in the future they could yet get involved in a future partisan gerrymandering dispute. Well, fast forward to 2019, and whatever hope was left was extinguished with the Rucho versus Common Cause case handed down by now the Roberts Court. So this is a court that now included both Trump appointees, and with a narrow 5-vote majority, the Chief Justice ended up echoing what Justice Scalia had earlier said in Veith, in holding that partisan gerrymandering claims were non-justiciable because, again, He believed that the federal courts lacked judicially discoverable and manageable standards for resolving partisan gerrymandering disputes. Now, I should note an interesting note that Roberts includes at the end of his opinion. He takes pains to emphasize that he doesn't think partisan gerrymandering is something to be celebrated, right? He takes pain to indicate that his holding should not be read to condone partisan gerrymandering. He concedes that in many respects, partisan gerrymandering is incompatible with democracy. However, for him and for the court majority, the solution for this problem just simply had to come from outside the federal courts, right? So it was a problem, and it was a problem that should be solved, but it just couldn't be solved by the federal courts because of this lack of manageable standards for resolving these claims. All right, so with those two cases now on the table, let me turn to the sort of next piece of this, of my remarks, the larger question in a sense. What exactly is wrong with partisan gerrymandering? What exactly is troubling about or problematic about it? So let me offer a couple of answers to this question, and these answers have all appeared in different parts of judicial opinions over the last number of years, and also offered by scholars and writing in this field as well. So from the standpoint of democratic principles, one of the most obvious problems with partisan gerrymandering lies in the fact that it has the potential to distort electoral and representational outcomes. So put simply, one might argue the very point of partisan gerrymandering is to artificially shape the partisan makeup of a representative body with the goal of artificially shaping policymaking by that body. Right, so basically we have a legislative body and policy outcomes that emerge from it that are not reflective of what the people truly believe because the body itself has been sort of distorted in its makeup, and as a result the policy that emanates from that legislative body is distorted as well. So the harm under this theory of partisan gerrymandering, this critique of partisan gerrymandering, is that it distorts representational and electoral or policy outcomes. Now, there's a second set of arguments about what's problematic about partisan gerrymandering. And the second set of arguments is less about outcomes. It's less about distortions in policymaking or distortions in a legislative body's makeup. A second set of critiques focuses instead on purpose, right? So again, for those who know their constitutional law, there's a really well-developed body of doctrine around racial discrimination where, you know, the focus is on invidious purpose. Right, that there are problems that flow from laws that are passed with discriminatory purposes. Well, in a very similar vein, those arguments are made about partisan gerrymandering too, that aside from the outcomes that emanate from it or the distortion to legislative bodies, the real harm is that decisions are being made about drawing these district lines with an illegitimate purpose. And that illegitimate purpose is the desire to harm one's partisan opponents, right? So, to quote from a concurring opinion from Justice Powell in the Bannermere case, this is what he says on this point about invidious purpose. He says, quote, "The Equal Protection Clause guarantees citizens that their state will govern them impartially. In the context of redistricting, that guarantee is of critical importance because the franchise provides most citizens their only voice in the legislative process. Since the contours of a voting district powerfully may affect citizens' ability to exercise influence through their vote, district lines should be determined in accordance with neutral and legitimate criteria. When deciding where those lines will fall, the state should treat its voters as standing in the same position, regardless of their political beliefs or party affiliation." Right, so again, the harm under this theory of partisan gerrymandering is that people are being treated differently, and in some cases at a clear disadvantage compared to their fellow citizens because of what their partisan affiliation is. And that is just, that's an illegitimate purpose. And then a third set of critiques, which is, you know, in some ways, of course, related to the other two, is that the problem with partisan gerrymandering is that it creates structural dysfunction in the practice of American democracy. And the forms of the structural dysfunction could be articulated in a number of different ways. Scholars have sort of gotten at this in a bunch of different ways. But one version of this is to say that partisan gerrymandering could entrench a version of minority rule. Right, people that could not win votes or elections in a fair contest are able to artificially advantage themselves and allow for the entrenchment of minority preferences because of their practice of partisan gerrymandering. But that's one version of this. That's a version focused on minority rule. Another version of this critique about structural dysfunction is this idea that partisan gerrymandering locks up the political system. It allows incumbents to entrench themselves, and it creates a sort of artificial lack of flexibility or innovation and competition in our electoral system because of these practices, right? So structural dysfunction is a third set of critiques. So let me conclude then with just a few comments on what I would take to be, or what I think is probably the main harm of partisan gerrymandering. So I think the critiques that I mentioned before all have some truth to them, and I think they all get to some of the harm of it. But if I had to sort of identify what I think is most central, I think the problem with partisan gerrymandering is that it violates a commitment to what I would call procedural integrity, right? So at its core, the ideal of procedural integrity speaks to this idea that when we have collective decision-making rules or processes, we want those rules or processes to be some distance, to be separate or detached from the outcomes that that process is going to generate. And so it doesn't mean that a fair collective decision-making process has to sort of be equally open to all outcomes and all possibilities, but it is to say that when we think about how to structure a voting system or how to structure a collective decision-making process, we want it to have some separation from the outcomes that are going to be decided under that process. Or to put this idea in more simple or more familiar terms, it just means that we should not have games that are rigged. And that is the problem with partisan gerrymandering. It rigs the electoral competition in such a way that it makes the process or the game illegitimate, right? The winners are sort of cooked. And so the whole practice of voting and engaging in democracy is basically theater. It doesn't actually have anything to do with a legitimate, genuine decision-making process. So given that, I think the harm of partisan gerrymandering, at least under those terms, is pretty clear. It sort of renders the process of democratic decision-making to be an irrelevance, right? Not the crucial component about how policies and outcomes are going to be determined. But I'll conclude with just a wrinkle to my argument. I think this commitment to procedural integrity is generally important, but I don't think it's important all the time in all democratic systems. And indeed, you know, if we think about the practice of partisan gerrymandering in our history, it has been widely practiced in our history for decades at certain parts, especially in certain parts of the in certain communities, but certainly a pretty long history beginning in the 19th century as well. And so, you know, American democracy survived during that point. Many have thought the democratic system to be legitimate during those periods. I think my claim is a bit more of a refined one. I think procedural integrity matters, but I think it matters more in certain contexts rather than others. And I guess the final thing I will say is I do think this commitment to partisan, this commitment to procedural integrity and this concern about partisan gerrymandering, these are things that I think are more weighty at the present moment in time. And the reason why I think so is because I think there are these three conditions at least that are present in modern American politics. And the presence of these conditions indicate the need for something like procedural integrity, and also at the same time indicate the potential harms, the particular harms of partisan gerrymandering. And so these are the three conditions that I see within modern American politics. First, that within the context of our federal elections, there are high policy stakes that are tied to our federal elections today, right? These are not elections where there's a clear majority and minority party. They are closely competitive parties. And so there are real policy consequences that are at stake. Second, we also see in modern American politics this dynamic where there are sharp ideological divisions within society, and these are mapped closely onto partisan divisions. It hasn't always been like that, but it's like that today. And third, we're also living in a context where the political elites in both parties strongly signal the desire for major policy shifts. And so given these three conditions, we're in a closely competitive electoral environment where elections matter a lot. And when we're in that sort of context, I do think the legitimacy of our democratic system hinges a lot on preserving procedural integrity and on being worried about the open practice of partisan gerrymandering. All right, so I think I'm probably at time there, so I will stop there. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Norman Turrell. I'm a former president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and I'm also the campaign chair for People Not Politicians, as well as a chief petitioner for the People Not Politicians Initiative 57. I want to do maybe three things in my little talk this morning. First, I want to outline the proposal that we've made in the Initiative 57. I want to talk about the results of our initiative petitioning, And I want to talk about the lawsuit that was filed in federal court, and you'll probably hear about soon in the news. And then maybe talk about next things that might happen with the initiative. So Initiative 57 was a proposal that we have got accepted by the Secretary of State through the ballot title process. And we spent a lot of time, maybe a couple of years actually drafting the proposal. The proposal grew out of a task force that Secretary of State Richardson organized several years ago. And I was a member of that task force. And they came out with a proposal that is basically the same outline as our initiative, except they had only a partial proposal, and they reported that to the legislature, and the legislature roundly ignored the proposal. That proposal of the task force was actually built on top of a ballot measure in California of over 10 years ago, which effectively is the same model of an independent commission to do the redistricting of the state legislature and congressional districts. The proposal includes three big parts. The first part is appointment of a commission of 12 people. The second part is the criteria by which the commission does its work. And then the third part is possible appeals to the Oregon Supreme Court. So let's take each of these in turn. The commission is appointed by a rather complex process of first having normal citizens apply to serve on the commission. Those citizens' applications then are reviewed by a panel of three administrative law judges, and then they're put into pools that represent the first largest political party in the state, the second largest political party of the state, and then everybody else based on their voter registrations. Those pools then have a random selection process by which the first six members of the commission are chosen, and those six commissioners then choose the next six commissioners from the same three pools, with the attempt to balance the commission, particularly in geography and diversity. The objective of the whole process for choosing commissioners is to eliminate people who have conflicts of interest in the process. So for example, people who are public officials or are candidates or are party officials or anybody related to those kinds of people are automatically eliminated from the pools that they're being selected from. And the other objective is to balance the political interests of the state so that no political party has any advantage in the process. And in fact, in the procedures of the proposed initiative, we require that they compromise with each other. And so there has to be at least one vote in the final maps from each of the three groups of commissioners. So to move to the criteria on which the commission bases its decisions and draws maps are very important. They are largely the criteria that are currently used by the state legislature, which are familiar: equal population, contiguous districts, trying to minimize transportation distances, and so on. There's two important criteria that we've either redefined or added, and one is communities of interest, and the second one is competitiveness. And these are, we think, important so that the voters in the process win out and that they have better choices in their districts. In fact, the competitiveness, we think, is important so that voters have, in fact, a possibility of changing their representation over what now happens in the legislature. Maybe I'll back up a little bit and describe that there's three kinds of gerrymandering. Professor Chin described partisan gerrymandering very well. The other two are racial gerrymandering. and bipartisan gerrymandering. Racial gerrymandering is in part taken care of by the Equal of the Voting Rights Act, which requires that there be minority districts wherever that it makes sense. Bipartisan gerrymandering is more insidious, perhaps, and that's where neither party in the process has an advantage, and so they tend to trade safe districts for incumbents, and in that process, the voters lose out also because they tend not have a ability to change their representation because of their safe districts instead of competitiveness districts. So the last part of the proposal is a possible appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court. Anybody in the state can appeal to the Supreme Court if they don't like the commission's product, and the Oregon Supreme Court has the final say as to whether or not the process that is laid out in the initiative has been followed and the criteria have been followed. And they would have the final word in that process and be the judge. So that's the general outline of the proposal. Going to the results of the initiative drive, we actually did not get the number of signatures that we are required to put it on the ballot. About 150,000 signatures are required for a constitutional amendment, and we didn't even come close to that, but we actually did pretty good under the circumstances. We got about 64,000 signatures collected. That was enough to demonstrate the viability of the issue. Since we couldn't get out onto the streets and do normal petitioning on one-to-one basis, because of the pandemic, we shifted and pivoted to a process where we did direct mail to 500,000 registered voter households, which represent about a little over 1 million voters in the state. And we did quite well in getting them to respond, but not well enough. A normal direct mail campaign usually gets about 0.5% response rate. We had around 6% ultimately in response rate, but we were hoping for more like 10%. We also did a digital campaign, emailing and through social media, asking people to sign the initiative through a download and print process, and then send it in the postal mail. That was rather successful too, however, not successful enough. Third part of our campaign would be to finally get it out onto the streets and do street petitioning. We had imagined that that the pandemic restrictions would be lifted in mid-May or at least in early June. And as you know, that didn't happen at all. So as a result of that, we filed a suit in federal court alleging that because of our First and 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution, that we didn't have an opportunity to really petition our government properly or have equal protection of the laws applied in the situation. And so that was the basis of the court. The court had an expedited hearing last Friday, and Shane in Eugene decided in fact, he decided to waive more than asked for, ordered the state either put us on the ballot or, secondly, give us more time up to August 17th. The Secretary of State was given until 5 o'clock yesterday to actually respond to this order. Secretary Clarno did respond. She essentially agreed to the second option. However, she also indicated that they would be appealing the order to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. And even though they said they were going to do that, they haven't done that as yet. So that's where the court case is. And this gets into some machinations that I don't actually entirely understand the motivation behind the appeal, because the voters have already sufficiently demonstrated their interest in this issue. We also have poll that we did early on that shows that the voters are very interested in this process and would probably readily pass it if we got to the ballot in November. So I think one way or another, this court case will be resolved in our favor. We're almost certain to be on the ballot in November at the end of this process, but that remains to be seen. I'm, of course, more optimistic than some people. Our opponents are trying to make this a partisan issue, and it's really not. It's a process issue that I compare to a double-edged sword. The sword can be used both ways, and it can cut in both ways in such a way that either party can have the advantage at different times. And in fact, in the history of the state, each party has had the advantage at different times. So I think the voters are astute enough to understand this process and the dangers of gerrymandering. And so they will readily pass it when we get on the ballot in November. So thank you very much. And now I'll introduce Senator Lee Beyer.
Good afternoon, and thanks for inviting me. I'm Lee Beyer. I'm a state senator. I represent Central Lane and Linn counties in the Oregon State Senate. My perspective on this is based on the fact that I've observed and been involved in three of the last redistricting proposals. I was appointed to the Oregon House in 91, actually after the legislature failed to do their job in redistricting, and it was turned to Secretary Kiesling. In 2001, I was involved in the redistricting process when, again, we couldn't come to agreement, and it turned to Secretary Bradbury to do it. And I was involved finally in 2011, where the legislature was, for the first time in modern history, able to come to agreement on a redistricting plan. My observation of having been involved the whole time is that I actually think that there is very little attempts to gerrymander in Oregon at all. And the reason is it's just really hard to do, even if you want to, in our state. Process requires it to use census data, which, by the way, is going to be very hard in the coming year, since it doesn't look like the census data is going to be available until October if the federal government follows through on what they've said, August. But you have to think about how you do this. The census of the legislature is drawn around House districts, and then each House district makes a Senate district. So they're what's called nested. Each of the House districts and each of the Senate districts, for that matter, have to meet some basic criteria. As Norm said, they have to be of equal population in the next census or in the next redistricting. That'll be roughly around 70,000 people. Each of them have to respect communities of interest. And I'll give an example of that. You know, you try to have districts that, if it's an urban area, that are urban, and if they're rural, you try to separate that out so that one side doesn't overwhelm the other. They also have to have simple things like if there is a city that falls completely within that district size, you have to include the whole city in that. And I'll give you a couple of examples of that. Springfield in our area, Corvallis, Bend, those are areas that by themselves define themselves as a representative district. Then you try to the extent you can, represent ethnic or racial minorities. And in Oregon, we really have three districts that were created that way. Secretary Kiesling in 91 tried to do it more up in the Hillsborough area. Secretary Bradbury very proudly created a Hispanic district around the Woodburn-Salem area. And historically, we've had a Black neighborhood in North Portland that we tried to represent to make sure that those minority interests hasn't. But the real issue gets down to, and when you're using natural boundaries in that, you have natural features like east of the Cascades. More than one third of the state is included in one Senate district over there that stretches from the Ben's sister's area. It doesn't include Ben, but it stretches from that all the way to the Idaho border and all the way to the Utah and Nevada borders on the south side. You have other areas like you try to do it along the Columbia River. The coast is another one. I remember during the last session, how we did redistricting in 2011 is we started out with, I think it was three different distinct maps that we took around and held about 12 or 15 hearings throughout the state. And I remember one distinct hearing on the coast where a former representative, Paul Hanneman, had suggested that what the coast really wanted was one Senate district from California to Washington and two House districts making up that Senate district. And I'd asked the question of him, I said, well, what you have now is you have about seven, I think it's six legislators that form what's called the Coastal Caucus that do a very effective job in representing the area. Do you really want to turn that into just having three? And his comment, and it was very commonly, he says, well, now that you mention it, forget what I said. Likewise, we had a discussion at Lynn Benton Community College that affected my district. And we were holding a hearing there, and we had my district was proposed to run all the way up to Highway 34. And we had a farmer in Tangent who said, well, I respect you very much, but you don't represent my interest. I don't orient towards Eugene. I orient towards Albany. So we went back and we changed the line. We moved it down to take that out. So you have those kinds of things in there. The real issue becomes the rural versus the urban. And I respect what Norm is saying, but I think that issue of competitiveness is going to be very hard to come up with. The reality is that the urban areas tend to be much more liberal or progressive, and that's who they elect. The people in the rural areas tend to be much more conservative, and that's who they elect. I've often said that one of the first things that surprised me when I was appointed to the legislature is that the people who were elected by the citizens generally really did represent the viewpoints of their districts. And that's one of the things that makes legislating very hard in the current environment is that people are very divided in their opinions now, and it's hard to pull things together. So that's tough. So those areas, and really it's like putting a jigsaw puzzle together. Having done this myself in two different times, when you say that makes a logical decision, then you go, oh, but there's only 50,000. Okay, where am I going to get the other 20,000? And you start moving those lines around and you say, okay, I'll go over here. And then you say, oh, that means I have to change these other four districts. And you start pushing it around. Frankly, usually you start from the south coast and start coming north. That's the way we've done it the last two times. And it's hard. The thing that happens the most is where the population growth is occurring. The population growth in Oregon is primarily in the northern end of the Willamette Valley in the metro area. We will probably see another seat go there in the House or two, and that then causes the puzzle to shift around quite a bit in the area. So and it just makes it very hard to put that together. Politically, I don't think you'll change the what I've told my colleagues over repeatedly is that, particularly those in rural areas, is the life that you're going to see is that the legislature is going to get much more liberal because we're becoming much more of an urban state. And so there will be fewer votes in the rural areas. So that's just the nature of the beast that we're looking at when you put that together. It's just a different perspective in life. And that makes it very hard to balance that issue. Try as we might, it's hard to do that. I have that example in my district. I have the House district that's all of Springfield, and then my companion House district has a slice of Eugene, and then it has eight other cities, 12 school districts, and probably another three or four communities that are unincorporated but are more urbanized. And my joke when I speak to groups, city clubs, for example, is my constituency is very homogeneous. The University of Oregon professors and my Linn County grass seed farmers all see things exactly the same. And that's a challenge. And I will tell you, as one legislator, and I'm in my last term, I'm done, so this won't have an effect on me directly. But I try very hard to try and balance that rural farmer and university professor, university student perspective. And it's difficult to do. I mean, that's the nature of the beast, but I don't think that changes much. I'd like to speak to the proposal a little bit. Actually, I'm somewhat ambivalent on having an independent commission do it, but I think this particular proposal has flaws in it. And the flaws are the structure, but I think you'll still have a partisan slant at the end because two-thirds of the membership are based on their party registration. The only challenge against that, I guess, is you assume that because they're not currently actively involved in an office position that they won't be partisan. I think that's probably not true. Secondly, I think the process will be very hard. I think the nature of the business, based on my experience with it, is it will become staff dominated because citizen members will just not have the time, even though they may be paid, to spend 6 or 8 months away from their normal life creating districts and traveling throughout the state asking the advice of the citizenry. I don't think that probably is going to work very well. And I'm fearful of that staff domination. I actually prefer to have it done by representatives. I guess if I were doing it, and the proposal I've thrown out in the past is, I think it would be better to use retired appellate court judges who are already being paid to have their senior status and let three of them do it. I think the public would view that as probably more balanced. And frankly, they would have the professional experience to probably do the job, and we'd be better at managing the system to do that. So I will stop there. I think that's the nature of it. I've had a lot of experience with it. And I actually think that the commission, when you finished up with it, if we had that, would end up with a map that looks pretty much the way that the one that would be drawn by the Secretary of the State or the state legislature, if they could agree, would, just because that's the nature of the way districts are in the area. The competitiveness and the partisanship is more driven by the social values of the areas of the state than it is by politics per se. Thank you for this opportunity.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for your comments. I appreciated hearing a bit more about the specifics of the Oregon context. So Senator Barr, maybe I'll start with you. Just a comment and then kind of a question to press a little bit about some of your comments. So the first is, you know, you mentioned some skepticism about this idea of an independent commission. And I'll say, you know, in the literature, there is some split opinion about this. There is an argument by actually a pretty strong skeptic of this, is a somebody who says California state politics, who argues that, you know, if there are these heated partisan debates at the legislative level or in the state legislative bodies, they're not going to magically disappear with independent commissions. Those conflicts will just transfer to those commissions where there could be sparring and litigation around how people are selected and so forth, right? So it may not be like a cure-all for all of it. But I did have a question for you. So when you were talking about your experience and what you'd seen with line drawing in Oregon, you mentioned that, you know, at least in your experience, what you'd seen, that there are constraints to the task of drawing lines, right? Population, where they're located, that sort of thing. And you also indicated that people took seriously this idea of communities of interest, right? And you gave some examples of where that had come up. So I guess a question I might ask is, for a skeptic, someone inclined to be skeptical of this, and, you know, hearing you talk, they would say, someone might ask, how seriously should we take this idea that legislators will generally take communities of interest to heart, right? I mean, you know, classic argument of political scientists who sort of think about legislative behavior is the desire for reelection. You know, if we take that as the starting point for legislative behavior, explains an awful lot about legislative behavior in a lot of different contexts. So taking your point that people might take communities of interest into account, but how would you address a skeptic who would say, well, I don't know. I mean, that sounds like an interesting narrative, but I really wouldn't believe that that would structure how people behave. I don't know. What would you say in response to that?
A good response. I guess I would say from my experience that hasn't been the case in Oregon. The demonstration, particularly the last, the 2011, paid a lot of attention to when we went out and listened to people and I gave the example of the coast and one in the valley. We actually paid a lot of attention to what people said and tried to make some adjustments there. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about, you know, like the Springfield, should that, you know, that's one, we have to do that. Ben was a bit of a problem. It's called the donut in the hole over there, because you tried to create a district that included Ben, and then you created a donut around it for another district, because truly, when you talk to the people there, the people, as I used to say to my planner friends when I was doing work with planners, people choose not to live in cities. And there's a reason. They have a different perspective on life than people who choose to live in cities. So you've got to see things. Although, obviously, we found, in my experience, Oregon's population, because you're constrained by the size of the population, it's very hard to do that. If you're trying to keep them together, keep, I guess, to answer directly, I says, I haven't seen a lot of examples of that. You know, there's probably a little bit around the edges, but basically, there's real attention paid on both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, to trying to respect communities of interest.
So, Mr. Turrell, let me just go to you. So a comment and then a question. In support of this idea, this proposal in front of you, I think it aligns with a lot of the critics of partisan gerrymandering who are, you know, to articulate the core complaint, it's there's something seems very wrongheaded to have legislators determine how they are going to be elected, right? So putting the power of that in the hands of a different institutional body, like a commission, is like a very obvious and in some ways, you know, a very commendable way to address that concern. I guess the question I want to throw to you is a question that often comes up for those that are skeptical of these sorts of reforms. Not to say they're necessarily defenders of partisan gerrymandering, but they're skeptical about these different solutions. And the question is this, you know, when you put forward something like a commission idea or a reform idea like this, is there an ideal like outcome that is the goal in mind that you're trying to achieve? Is it the elimination of bias? Is it a certain sort of representational distribution? What for you anyway, when you think about the problem of partisan gerrymandering, what is the problem you're trying to correct? And just as a follow-up to this, you know, this comes up a lot in the judicial opinions as well. I think there is a background intuition in a lot of this discussion of something like proportional representation. In my opinion, by the way, I think proportional representation is fine, but it's very disfavored within our current law. But for you, what is the harm that you're seeking to correct with this commission?
Thank you, Professor Chin. First, I'll acknowledge that there are other solutions to this problem. And you mentioned proportional representation, and there's really a whole array of alternate voting methods that we could get into. But that's not the issue right here. And that would be a whole different initiative drive probably to get that instituted in Oregon. So the goal to me is to put the voters in charge of their public officials instead of the other way around. The tendency has been in the past for the districts to be gerrymandered to one extent or another so that the voters are in safe districts, which means that they don't really have much opportunity to change their representation. And so typically the criteria of competitiveness is important in this process. And we have, by the way, balanced that with three or four other criteria. So there's no absolute requirement for competitiveness, but it has to be balanced together with the communities of interest and transportation links and geographic boundaries and so on. So this is a inherently human process because there's a lot of judgment required in the process. Some people have proposed that computers can do the whole job. And I would vehemently disagree with that because it has a lot of subjective decisions that have to be made in arranging the voters in the districts. The other concept that I want to maybe make clear is that some people think that having irregular boundaries is the problem with gerrymandering, but that's the only perception problem because they think back to the original salamander shape district in Massachusetts. And it's really not about the shape, it's about the voters who are actually placed in the districts. And so focusing on putting voters in districts in such a way that they are better able to choose their voters, choose their public officials, instead of the public officials choosing their voters, I think is the main objective in the process.
Right. And going on some of the comments you made as well, when you talk about maximizing competition, I hear you to be talking about it, not just as partisan competition, but also competition between challengers and incumbents as well. Right. So it's a broader, yeah. broader principle. Right.
Yeah. And competition of ideas as well. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be partisan ideas. It can be other kinds of ideas. And, you know, one of the arguments that I've heard our opponents say about our proposal is that it's not going to be responsible to the voters. Well, my contention is that the legislature is not responsible to the voters either, because this is a process that only happens every 10 years, and the voters really don't have a memory that long, they tend to focus on issues that are of greatest importance to them, like taxes or climate change or schools or something. And that's what they hold their legislators accountable on. But redistricting gets lost in the noise usually.
So I guess I've directed, but Senator Beyer, do you want to respond to anything that?
I'm just kind of curiosity. The way the process would work, as I understand it, Norm, is that people would volunteer, put their name in to be on the commission, and then there'd be a screening process, I guess a random drawing of who gets there. But just the fact that you're doing self-selection, isn't that tend to, I would think that would tend to, you're going to get people who are more politically motivated volunteerings, so you're going to get some of the same thing. Involvement there. I would think you'd have a lot of people that were active in the political parties that would put their name in. And probably most people would choose not to, because they don't want to give up 3 to 6 months of their time to this process.
So that's a very good question. First of all, the process is maybe a little more elaborate in that after the initial applications, there's a panel of three administrative law judges that actually examines all the applications and removes people that have strong conflicts of interest that I described before. And they also are looking for ability in the process so that people aren't totally clueless. And the commissioners are required to have been at least living in the state for 3 years or registered voters for 2 years, in such a way that they have some knowledge of the system in the state. And so it's not entirely random. And the commissioner's term of office is actually 10 years. It's not 3 or 6 months, as you have suggested. But this is the same proposal, at least in this feature, as California. And it's actually worked out quite well in California. Those commissioners are willing to serve in this capacity. And you'd think there would be a shortage of people who are willing to do this kind of work, but in California, they had 32,000 applicants, and 8,000 of those filled out a long application to be scrutinized by, and so there's really no shortage of people who are willing to serve the state in this way, and they're able to separate themselves from the process as much as possible, even though they are appointed to balance the political interests of the state, they actually tend to cooperate more than you would think otherwise. And so the commission is designed to get it out of the highly partisan area of the legislature that has shown itself in the last 100 years to have failed most of the time, and put it into an arena where the voters can win in the process instead of the public official.
I guess the demonstration, other than 2011, is that it hasn't really been a politically driven process, because the legislature has never been able to come to agreement except once.
Yeah, that once was 1981, and the...
No, it was 2011.
Well, 2011, I'll want to address in a moment, but in 1981, the legislature was able to actually pass a bill. However, it was appealed to the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court ordered the Secretary of State to make some corrections in the boundaries. In 2011, we would suggest that that was a special case, that the Oregon House was equally divided between Republicans and Democrats, and the Senate wanted to also be bipartisan about the process. And so it had appointed equal number of Democrats and Republicans to the Joint Committee. And what effectively they did was come out with what we would call a partial bipartisan gerrymander, in which, according to Ballotpedia, we lost three or four competitive districts to more safe districts in the process. And so I'm of the opinion that the legislature at the time did absolutely the best that they could under the circumstances, but the circumstances are not likely to be repeated again anytime soon in the state's history. So I applaud the legislature for what they did in 2011, but we think we can do better. The initiative, the process that we've come up with, I don't think we can claim that it's the best process ever, because nobody really knows what that best process would be. But I do claim that we can do it much better than the legislature has been able to do it in the past.
So I think that might have to be the last word. We're getting a nod from our moderator. The time is up. So thank you all for your comments. I appreciate learning all this.
Thank you.
This has been our July 17th program. Should citizens choose their legislators, or legislators choose their citizens? Before we close, I'd like to recognize some gold sponsors: Pacific Cascade Federal Credit Union, Jerry Diethelm, architect, landscape architect, Dr. Sandy Ibarra of Hearing Associates, and thank you to our in-kind sponsors, KRVM 91.9 Radio, PAC Info and Simplified Computing, LLC, Dotson's Photography, and Network Charter School. It is our expectation to have our taped conversations available by Fridays at noon. We want to thank you all for supporting us during this difficult time. And a special thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7 for airing City Club programs on Mondays at 7 p.m. Next week, we will offer the first segment of a two-part series on law enforcement. The death of George Floyd on May 25th sent off a series of protests across the United States and around the world, prompting greater public attention to the excessive use of public force, as well as concerns about police oversight and accountability. Several other deaths, primarily of Black Americans, including Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, have compounded and magnified calls for defunding or abolishing the police, in addition to other strategies for police reform. This two-part City Club series will examine local law enforcement through the lens of recent events. This timely and urgent conversation will survey Eugene's history of law enforcement in light of the larger issues around police accountability and reform. At the heart of these programs is a question: how can we cultivate and enforce greater equity, justice, and public safety in our community in light of where we've been and what direction we want to head? Please join us again on July 24th. More details and information about future programs can be found online at the City Club of Eugene's website, cityclubofeugene.org. Now, I would like to acknowledge today's speakers: Stuart Chin, Lee Beyer, and Norman Terrell. Thank you for a very interesting and informative program. This concludes today's forum. Be well and stay safe.